Good Monday morning, TSP audience, the TSP community. Thanks for tuning in today. This entire show came from a single Facebook post. So I happened to be on a different platform, and I saw an advertisement, one I'll show you in a little bit. And it was for guns, about 1971, and they had the prices. And you could buy things like, I'm going off of my head here because I don't have the ad in front of me, but I think a Winchester 30-30, just as one example in this ad, was like $80. And some of the people that saw the post, both there and on X, said, but wait a minute, when you do the calculations for inflation, it's about the same price. Can anybody there in the live stream chat, there's only about 20 people as I continue to pour in, a little out of time once you start, the notices go out, people show up. Anybody in there tell me why that's like not surprising at all that an item that costs more today compared to the time in the past would actually be pretty close to equal to inflation? Is it because that's how inflation works? Is that because the number is actually consistent with some level or degree of it? In fact, some people said, you know what, Jack, when you really look at it, if you like bought a Mossberg shotgun on sale, it actually costs less today relative to inflation. Really? So that led me to realize something, that in spite of doing this now for 17 and a half years, I've been doing this show roughly, it'll be, I guess, the 20th. Will be 17 and a half years exactly. No, January 20th will be 17 and a half years exactly. So by next month, it'll be 17 and a half years. By this summer, I'll be doing this for 18 years. On some level, I guess I failed. Not horribly or anything. I mean, the fact that people in my audience, people that follow me, would do the math, I applaud that. And I'm being serious. I'm not picking on anybody here. But if you only look at inflation as a calculation based on numbers only, and you're using the dollar, which, as we discussed in an episode last week, is like changing an inch, shrinking the inch, and still calling 12 inches a foot, and then saying the house, the size of the house didn't shrink or something like that, then you're missing the point. How do you get money? Where does your money come from? Does anybody here have a money tree? Like you go outside and there's just money growing. Remember, you used to, if you're a Gen X, your boomer and silent parents used to tell you, money doesn't go on trees, right? And they're right. Like, I don't have a money tree. Yeah, and I do okay for it, but I ain't found a money tree yet that actually grows money. I've had to grow things that are valuable that can be exchanged for money, right? Or replace things you would have to buy with money. But I've never had a tree grow me money. I've never found a seed I could plant, and then money just springs up out of the ground. I wish for money. It did not rain down on my head. Like, I don't know about you, but all the ways that I've got money involve me doing something for it. Now, as an entrepreneur, it's not that direct exchange correlation of hours worked to dollars earned. I made money yesterday while I was watching my granddaughter do gymnastics. I got some sales that came in on the alert on my phone, right? So I've broken free of that. But most people haven't. And when you're judging something on how it impacts a country, you shouldn't judge it on how it impacts people who have broken free of the system of control, at least to some degree, entrepreneurs, the truly wealthy, things like that. You should judge it based on the way it affects the average Joe. So how does the average Joe get money? Where does it come from? Well, unless they're on welfare or something like that, they go out and they work and they get paid by the hour for it. And there's an interesting thing that happens when we calculate the cost of things based on how long you have to work based on a median salary today versus how long you had to work based on a median salary in, let's say, 1970, which is what I use for my calculations. And we're going to get into this in a minute. I'm going to tell you why. Like, this should actually make you more horrified than it probably will, because I don't think there's anybody that would tell you 1970 was a good year in America. It wasn't. What happened in 71? We left the gold standard. Why? The economy was dog shit. The entire 70s were a terrible economy. The economy was still dog shit in 1980 when Ronald Reagan took office. Remember that? Some of you don't, but some of you do. And 2 years into it, people were saying Reagan was making the economy worse. It wasn't until about a year before his reelection that things started to turn around. So when we look at it that way, these increases over that time are worse because it wasn't a boom time in America at all. If we were to go back and redo these calculations in 1955, and the reason I didn't is because the ad was 72, 70 was a nice round number coming off of that. It gave us a direct, 55 years in time differential between today and that time. And actually getting the numbers to do these calculations was hard enough to keep like-for-like comparisons from 70 to 2025, let alone 55. But if we did this in 55, when the economy was good, when we still had silver in our change, when we were still really on some version of the gold standard, not the pretend gold standard, right? We went to the pretend gold standard and the pretend. So we were on at least the pretend gold standard instead of the pretend, which is what we ended up on in the 60s, which is how we ended up with no gold standard by the 1970s when Nixon called time of death. So what you're going to learn today is, well, it's actually frightening. And some of you that are really, really hard on these, and I admit a lot of them are idiots, these idiots that went to college and have degrees and nothing, and they're complaining about their student loans. You're going to have a whole new, if you like put yourself through college or some shit, I want you to tell me how you would do that today with the same way that you did it back then, like working the same kind of level of a job or something like that. Or if your parents helped you out, you paid half of your tuition and they paid half, and maybe you borrowed a little bit of money and then you paid that off in a couple of years. I want you to tell me how you would do it today, because the numbers I'm going to give you are going to break your neck with the way they're going to snap you back. I'm telling you just that. And then, of course, we're going to go into, well, what do we do? Because we ain't going to fix the problem. The problem will have to go through numerous resets, and they're going to be very painful. And what do we do to build for our future, depending on how old we are, too? Because, for someone like me, I don't like this, right, and how it impacts me. But the reality is I'm going to be okay no matter what at this point. If I were 19, 20, 21 years old again, especially if I didn't know what I know now, and there wasn't somebody, like me and others out there, like at least you guys have the internet today and people that can communicate with you and tell you what's really going on and how to do something about it, I don't know what would have happened. I don't know if I could have ever built the life that I've built if I had to start at 20 years of age in 2025. I think it's a lot harder now than it was then in some ways, as we'll see today. In some other ways, there's more opportunity today if you see it than there's ever been in history. That's something else we'll talk about. Before we do, though, let's go ahead and talk about a way to preserve wealth as you're earning it. And one way to do that is to invest in precious metals, specifically silver and gold. And if you're going to be buying silver and gold, the thing is, buy from a reputable dealer. If you do that, most everything else takes care of itself, because silver is silver and gold is gold. A 1 ounce eagle is a 1 ounce eagle. You got it, right? A 1 ounce bar of gold is a 1 ounce bar of gold. A quarter ounce gold coin is a quarter ounce gold coin. They are the same. So what that means is, once you know you got a good dealer, why would you go to the dealer that charges you more? Well, you shouldn't. Why would you go to the dealer that charges you more and then charges you shipping on your larger orders? Well, you shouldn't. You should go to the one that charges you less and ships free. You should go to the one that gives you a discount on larger orders through your membership in My Member Support Brigade. So you got better pricing, free shipping, and a discount, and a company that supported this show going back to 2013. That's right. This company has been supporting us for 12 years in the world of podcasting. I also can talk to the owner directly whenever I need to if there's a problem, and I haven't had to do that in about 9 years. There was some little hiccup problems that were going on back in the very beginning. This company was really new at that point. And every time I reached out to the president of the company, his name's Michael, you know what he said to me? He said, Jack, thank you for helping me tighten my company up and making our service better. That's the kind of company you want to do business with. So if you want to preserve your wealth with silver and gold, go to jmbullion.com. Next up today is, well, we're going to talk about wealth today. So why not the Wealth Studying Podcast with John Pugliano? John is going to tell you this week his latest podcast came out. Well, actually came out late last week, December 12th. It was Going to College, Don't Waste Time or Money. Now, this is actually not an episode on not going to college. It's an episode on, well, should you go to college given what you are looking forward to in your life at this point? And for many people, the answer would be no, you should not. It will be a waste of both time and money. Check out John's podcast. Again, it's at wealthspending.com. John is one of us. He's 40 years of investing experience, an entrepreneur, author, inventor, and founder of Investable Wealth, LLC. Check out John's stuff, guys. You really are going to learn a lot. And in his podcast, you'll learn things like what he's doing with his money and his clients' money right now. And a guy that has his track record of success, that might be something you just want to know. All right, so before we dig into this, I just want to comment on something here. Kevin says, good cold afternoon. It is cold. What the hell is going on? This is Texas. It's only December. You guys up north, like Minnesota and Wisconsin and over where I used to be from in Pennsylvania, whatever, your weather is drunk and stumbling around in Texas. Please come get it and take it home. It's welcome here in like mid-January, not right now. I don't know what's going on. Everything's frozen this morning, and it's not fun. And the dog doesn't want to go out. The cat doesn't want to go out. And the jack doesn't want to go out. That's how cold it is. I'm inside, and I'm wearing a hoodie sweatshirt. Anyway, let's get into this in seriousness, because this is a serious topic. So, again, I found this ad, and let me put, if you happen to be in the video, you could see this, and I'm going to see if I can maybe actually blow it up a little bit bigger for you. That's too big. You guys don't see it, so, yeah, this will be a little better right here. I'm going to switch to this tab, and you can see because you can see the prices a lot better there and what they're on. So for those that are listening to audio, I'll give you the gist. This is like a newspaper type ad or maybe a magazine, old, faded, yellowed. And it is for a company called Gibson's Discount Center. And they were, you know, like a more independent, like a Sears or a Kmart, or we think it was a Walmart today, kind of general store type situation, kind of a regional chain. They had an Ithaca pump action shotgun on sale for $109 in 12 or 20 gauge. At 1100 Remington, and those are just one of the most perfect semi-auto shotguns ever made, $144. An H&R single shot, $35. A Remington 3006 in semi-auto, 7.42, $144. A Mossberg pump shotgun 12 gauge, $64.97. A Marlin 3030, that's a 336A. Lever gun. They still make that gun. Some very minor changes to it, including the cross block safety, which is retarded. $80. Remington 22 semi-auto, $50. An H&R 22 9-shot 5.5-inch barrel pistol, $40. And a Sterling 25 auto, which I would never have bought no matter how cheap it was because it's junk, but $35. Now, like I said, correctly, some of the people at both X and Facebook did the math and said, hey, when I account for inflation, some of these guns are about the same price. And like the Mossberg, the price actually went down relative to inflation. Let's talk about, first of all, why something like a firearm would be less affected by inflation than many other things. First of all, these guns, like I said, we're largely unaltered. Many of them are still made almost exactly the same way that they were made. They might use poor quality materials, especially the wood on something like an 1100, but all the machinery, all the equipment, all the dies, all the tool, everything that they need to make it was built already. It existed. Then efficiency in manufacturing and distribution. And on some level, we're looking at a technology here. Okay. Guns are a technology product. And because of that, we all know tech goes down in price despite inflation. So we can buy a 70-inch screen TV at Costco today, and even adjusted for inflation the way we're going to do it, it is less expensive than your boomer grandfather paid for a crappy 25-inch console Magnavox TV back in 1985. Okay? That's fine. So there's a technology, there's an economy of scale, there's an efficiency doing downward pressure. And yet the prices are just kind of balanced with inflation. Now, the reason that I did ask you guys a question. Why would a product match inflation and be a little higher, a little lower, but pretty much right in the range of inflation. Well, I don't mean any disrespect to the people that did the math and pointed this out, but duh. And when I say that, I'm not really saying it to you. I'm saying it to the world as a whole, because we've been tricked into this belief system that this is perfectly normal, and that somehow if something stays with inflation, that's good. And somehow if we don't have inflation, that's bad. We're supposed to have a little bit. Even Trump says, oh, we got almost zero inflation. We have a little bit. You need a little bit. You got to have a little bit. You have none. That's bad, too. No, it wouldn't be. Nobody here would get angry if your cost of living over time stayed the same or slowly went down. You'd be pretty happy about that. And I mean your actual cost of living, not adjustments you make to your income, savings, and distributions so that you feel that it went down. I mean for everybody. Nobody would bitch about that. So the people in charge, because it's part of the mechanism of control. I want you to think about it this way. Like when you write a compensation plan for a salesperson, you build breakpoints into it to push them to do more. But what you also build is an out for yourself, if you're a scumbag employer, which 99% are, that works like this. Your year's over. Here's all the money we promised you, but now here's your new plan. You have a new quota, and you're, even if it's the same plan, by just raising your target, your metrics to make the same money get harder. Why do we do that? Well, we do that because if you have a really good salesperson, they build up a big enough book of business, 4 or 5 years in, they're kind of in maintenance mode. Like they'll pick up some new business here and there, but they're not going to hunt like they do in the first year. That first year, they're out there hunting. By the fifth year, they're farming. They're making sure they get reorders. They're making sure their customers stay happy. And what a company should do is hire a new hunter to go out and do the same thing. But instead what they do, they keep making it harder for you to make a living, no matter how much money you've made them in the past and continue to make them. And they do that so you'll keep hunting. They want you motivated. They want the carrot out here dangling in front of you, the carrot you'll never get to. The driver's got the stick. You're pulling the drive. You're pushing the carrot while you're pulling the driver, right? This is what they do to society as a whole with inflation. It is a byproduct of the system itself, but the people that built the system knew what it would do, and they were completely at peace with it, right? They were totally at peace with this because they were the kind of people that thought this way, that we always have to keep the carrot in front of the horse so the horse will keep pulling the carriage that they're riding it. Because that's what we are. We're a bunch of freaking livestock that moves the needle for them. So if we're going to actually measure the cost of something like those guns, then we need to measure it in how long does the normal person need to work in order to buy the thing? How many man hours, how much of your life force goes into buying any product, no matter what it is, right? It doesn't matter if it's a gun, right? It doesn't matter if it's a phone. It doesn't matter if it's a little tool. How long did you have to sacrifice of your own labor to store up enough battery to then redistribute that energy that you gained by expending your own energy, that exchange you made, to buy the thing? And when you look at it that way, everything changes. Those guns in general went up only, and I say only because this is actually a good number. You're about to see how good a number this is. They only really went up 10 to 15% in hours worked. So, yes, as inflation rises, so do wages. But, of course, that's been divergent. It's gotten more divergent in the last 5 years than any time in history. Thank you, Mr. Potato Head. At least he's gone. That's all I can say. So we have to measure it in time, and this is the one thing you can never get back. You can make $1 million and squander it in a month. And if you knew how to make $1 million once, you probably can make it again faster than you did the first time. This is why the lottery winner goes broke and stays broke for the rest of their life. They never learned how to make the money. And they never had an appreciation for the sacrifice that goes into $1 million. So when they win a $1 million lottery, they go piss it all away and they end up broke. And it's something like 78% of lottery winners are bankrupt, so below broke, in 5 years or less, because they have no idea how to handle that power, right? But if you earn it, you can earn it again. And many times this has happened. Many people have built up large multi-million dollar empires, had everything collapse, and they actually become millionaires again a second time faster. And they don't lose it a second time because they learned both sides of it, how to earn it, and then they learned how to keep it. You have to suffer some to really learn anything. I'm telling you. But if you waste a year of your life, you're never getting that year back. You can do things to prolong your life, to live longer, and to stay healthy later in life and active later in life. You still would have had that year that's gone. If you get put in prison for 5 years, think of what that really is. That's 5 years of your life you do not control. You'll never get it back. So when we work for somebody, we're trading that precious commodity of our time and our life force for money. So we need to look at how much of that time it takes to buy things. We also need to use median wages here, not minimum wage. Now, it is true in 1970, a lot more people earned a minimum wage with the job than today, as far as a percentage. It was still very, very low, and it was still entry level when we're talking full-time work. We should not be looking at people who work, 15 hours a week here to figure out this calculation. We need a person that works a full-time job. What is the median salary? And median is not just better than minimum. It's also better than average. Averages can be skewed. You throw a few billionaires in and all of a sudden the average income is elevated. You throw a bunch of people that earn $0 and it's pulled the other direction. So either side extreme can cause a corruption to an average. A median is actually a very good way to determine an average working wage. When you say median, that means half the people, regardless of how much more, the total body count is half make more and half make less than that amount of money. That's the center in numbers of bodies and income. So it's a very good metric to use. That's why we're using this today for what I'm about to give you. And we're going to look at some items here that we can measure in time worked versus dollars. And they're things that people buy and need and require, from little things to some really big things that we're going to go through. Give us a good snapshot of what's going on. But again, I want you to remember, 1970, not a good time in America. If we were looking at 1955, which would be, another 10, 15 years back. If we, to be fair, let's say we dropped this from 2025, and we went back to 2010, that would be the same spread, it would look worse. It was just hard to get the numbers from 55. And I thought 70 was a good number. Many of you guys were born around that year, a little after, a little before. This is something you're pretty familiar, most of you, with the timeline in between. Even people like you remember 1990 to now, things were a lot closer to 70 and 90 than they are today. Not just in time, but in money, all right? Because some of those numbers don't look that great from what I remember in the mid-80s. But let's look at ground beef. Now, I'm also going to say this. I had to pull composite numbers based on national averages, and my concern was more that I was treating 1970 and 2025 the same than if I believed the number to be 100% accurate in of itself. As long as I'm pulling from the same data set, the spread will be representative. I hope that makes sense. So in 1970, the average median income earner worked about 9.4 minutes to buy a pound of beef, ground beef. Okay. We're not talking about sirloin steak or ribeye, just ground beef. Today, the average worker is working about 14.8 minutes to buy the same pound of 80-20 ground beef, because that's what I base it on. That's an increase of 58%. So the real cost in life force for a pound of ground beef is 58% higher. Yeah, that might sound bad. It can get worse. Cars are actually one of the bright spots. I know it doesn't seem like it with $100,000 F-150s, but you can still buy, we look at median car, working man's car, right? 1970, you had to work 846 hours to fully pay for a car. Now, this isn't financing. This is on MSRP, okay? In 2025, you have to work 1,477 hours to pay for a car with a median income and a median car. That's a 28% increase. Not 20% more expensive in dollars. It's a lot more in dollars. But 28% more in your life force necessary to get this done. How about a new house? I mean, this is the expense, either rent or mortgage, is the expense everybody has to have sooner or later. You can only live in your parents' basement so long before even they charge you rent if they have any brains. In 1970, it took 131 weeks of median salary to buy a median 3-2 home. That's just what it took. In 2025, it takes 323 weeks worth of median income to buy a median home. Again, I'm going to say this, 131 weeks to 323 weeks. So don't give me this bullshit about inflation. What does it take to get the thing done? That's what matters to the average person, right? That's, by the way, that is 147% increase. You have to work 147% harder to buy an equivalent home. And I tried to be equivalent with square footage, bedrooms, and baths. I based this on a 1,400 to 1,600 square foot 3-2 home, national average prices, median income 70, median income 2025. So again, you might not agree with this. You might think you have to work harder, a little bit less, but the spread is based on equivalencies on both ends of the spread. How about, you know, for renters, two-bedroom apartment? In 1970, you had to work about 25 hours of your month, of your work, went to your housing to rent a two-bedroom. 25 hours. So a little more than half of one of your week went to just your housing. And everything else, you know, to pay for your electric bill and all that. This is just rent. This is an electric bill, water, all that shit. What do you think it is in 2025? Two-bedroom house. 51 hours a month. So a week and some. Now, the interesting thing about this, most apartment complexes, when you fill out a rental thing, and a lot of individual landlords do this too, they will not rent to you at more than 25% of your monthly gross income. Right there, the average is above what used to be a standard that if you can't meet this, you're out. So I bet you they raised that number because they had to, or people lie, or landlords look the other way, or what have you. That increase is 108%. So to rent somebody else's basically big giant room, a two-bedroom apartment, right, you got to pay off, you got to put out 108% more effort than you did in 1970. 4 years of room, board, tuition, and books in college at a public university. This is the one that you're going to have a new appreciation for all those whiny-ass little bitches who can't find a job other than Starbucks crying about their student loans. Remember, we told them, when I say we, I mean collectively we, the whole country, their teachers, their coaches, their parents, their guidance counselors, their ministers, everybody told. Every child should go to college. Johnny, you'll end up being a janitor if you don't go to college. Shit like that, right? Okay. It took 370 hours of work at median income. 370 hours of work at median income to pay for a college degree in 1970. Okay. Hey, what do you think it's today? This is based on about $80,000, which I think is low. But I went, again, I went like-to-like comparison. 2,956 hours. Increase, 699%. I went to two different AI tools and checked the math. They both said, yeah, this is valid. I mean, I can't be right. It is. It's almost a 700% increase in what it takes in your life force to pay for your college. But wait, there's more. Okay. In 1970, only about 10% of graduates left school with debt, which means 90% of people were able to work and pay their way through school in 1970. 90%. Now, you also had more Pell Grants and things like that, so there was assistance. But whatever was left, 9 out of 10 college students left school with zero debt in 1970. Zero. Today, 70% of grads leave with debt. That was the only number I could find. It was repeatable. I find it to be low. I find it to be low. I think that number is wrong. I do not think 30% of people are paying for their school. It might have something to do with the number of people who are accounted as students but not holding debt because they're foreign exchange students, so their debt's from somewhere else or they're on some sort of other way that it's being paid for. I was unable to correct that. But even going 10%, you know, 90% PAYGO to only 30% PAYGO, that just makes that number worse because my 699% increase does not include how much it actually costs you to service the debt over 10, 12, 15 years or more. Some of you have your college debt around so long, you might as well name it and call it a pet. I want you to and Kevin's right, to pay for your indoctrination. The more indoctrinated you are, the more valuable you are to the system that indoctrinates you. Isn't that shocking? Okay, so what does this mean? And what should we all be doing about it today? I mean, if we got something that bad, we got to do something. And there's only so much we could do. First step, obviously you should make as much money as you can. And you should curtail your spending as much as you can without turning your life into where you look like I do right now with my Santa beard. You know, you feel like you're a homeless guy on the street, right? We don't want to go that far down with cutting, but we need to cut. But then we need to think, well, what do we do with the money that we actually earn that we don't spend on things that are required spending, like mortgage or rent? Like, we don't really have a way to not have that expense. Some way we have to pay for housing, right? Well, I mean, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to stack real assets, not cash. And to do that, we need to know what an asset is. And when I said assets, I didn't just say an asset. I said a real asset. And this is an important distinction. If you buy something for a business, like a real big, giant $100,000 vehicle, truck, right? On your balance sheet is an asset. It also depreciates, and you cannot borrow against it other than to purchase it. And even if you put it up as collateral on a loan because you take really good care of it, you completely pay for it, and you need some money, so you want to put it in hock, basically, you can't get a normal type of loan on it. You're going to get, like, basically like a pawn store, a pawn shop store interest rate, even if you're not going to a pawn shop to do that, because don't do that. I'll go to a pawn shop. It's not a real asset. It is a depreciating asset, which is another word for a long-term productive liability. That's what a vehicle is. It goes down in value over time. You can't leverage it other than the utility that it can perform for you, and you're basically renting it because you know it won't last forever. Okay? So it's an asset, but it's not a real asset. It's an important distinction. And even the accountant that puts it in your asset column and then depreciates it as an expense on your paperwork for your taxes will acknowledge it's not a real asset. It is just an asset. So we want to stack real assets, and real doesn't always mean real estate. Okay. They also are, if you have a real asset, it can be sold relatively quickly for a known price. Now, maybe if you have more time to sell it, you can get more for it. But there is a floor price, a market value of an asset that, you know, if I sold this business today, I can get minimum $1.5 million. Like, if I put the business on the market for that price, it won't make a month and somebody's going to buy it. If I put this house on a market for $480,000, it's going to sell. That's probably too low. I should probably be looking for like $520,000. I'm going to get an offer in that range, maybe a little over, a little under, but I might have to wait a while. But I know, like, a mark-to-market price, if I put this up for this price, there's an investor that's going to just instantly jump on it. That's what your spot price with a metal, which is also an asset. If I have 10 ounces of silver, I know I can go to any store that's trades in silver, and I can get, you know, X minus spot minus X for it, for that small service fee. And I know I can sell it. If I can't do that with it relatively quickly to what it is, it takes longer to sell a house than it does to sell a silver coin, but both can be sold relatively quickly for a known appraised value. That's a real asset. If it ain't that, it ain't a real asset. They're durable across time. It's another way of saying they do not depreciate in value because the utility of the asset remains relatively constant across time. And when we say time here, we're talking decades minimum. My house today is 46 years old. It provides me utility. I could sell it really, really quick for more than I paid for it. It's an asset. I also, as I said earlier, I can borrow against it, right? It's durable. It's held up. It might require maintenance. I mean, sooner or later, I'm going to have to put new siding on this thing. I ain't looking forward to that. Probably I got about 10 years left in this roof. I'm going to put a roof on it. But it's still a house, and it's still worth money. And even if I don't put the roof on it, I can still sell it. I can still borrow against it. And it will, and as long as I don't let it go to complete shit, it will hold value across many more decades. Very simple to understand what a real asset. They also provide future economic benefit. If there is no economic benefit to a thing in, let's say, 20 years out, then it has no real asset utility. So those are the, that's the characteristics. And there's not a ton of stuff, right? There's not a ton of stuff that checks all those boxes. A business that's well managed and run, as long as it remains that way, checks that box. Real property does that. Equities in companies that are premium equity products and companies do that. Guaranteed payment bonds, not what I'm going to recommend you do, but they at least do that. Bitcoin does that. Silver and gold do that. Very few other things do that. Most other things that continue to hold and grow in value, they do not do it through the intrinsic value that they have. It's just because a house has value. A business has value. Bitcoin has value. They do it for some form of numismatic collector's value, right? A piece of art holds its value and grows across time because it's a special piece of art. Make one that looks just like it, but a different guy painted it, it's friggin' not worth the material that you used to paint it. You see how that works? So those are like these outliers. And by the way, most of the artwork, you know, if it's not a Da Vinci or a Van Gogh or something, most of that shit is a scam. It's a billionaire's controlled scam. They make these artists famous by buying their pictures in the first place. They get appraisers in their pocket. The appraisers say, oh, this is worth $100,000 because Dudley Do-Right stubbed his toe and used blood and ink and whatever, you know. And then they have it reappraised every so many years so they can borrow against it. So it meets that criteria of something with future value, holding up across time, being able to be borrowed against, but it's because it's all part of a scam. Because it has no utility to anybody and nobody really cares. You know, because again, it's not Van Gogh, right? It's not an Andy Warhol picture of a soup can or whatever. It's, you know, Chevy Fufu, who they just created out of thin air with no real talent, no mastery of what he's doing. Modern art is garbage. Okay. But that's still fits it because they made it fit it. So another thing we need to do though is we need to develop hard skills. And in this day and age, we need to develop hard skills that are AI resilient, AI resistant, non-brittle in a world where AI exists. I mean, it doesn't ever have to be something that AI doesn't aid with or help with, but there must remain a human component in it that a Tesla robot's not going to be able to do for a fraction of human cost. And there's only so much of that out there, but there's more of it than you think. Here's just some examples, though. Electrical and plumbing and anything like that. There's no AI going to do this anytime soon. Your kids will probably be dead before we have a robot that can go into a new construction site and install, you know, do pipe fitting work and figure out, well, what do I do now that that header is there that wasn't supposed to be there when I ran the pipe? Or it wasn't on a blueprint. I mean, because shit like that's still going to happen. So when it requires this on-the-fly decision-making capability, it requires checking with code compliance, all of those things that these types of trades require. Nor is a robot going to get in a robo-taxi and come to your house and pump out your shitter tank if you have a septic system, or unclog your sewer line running to city sewer. Like plumbers, pipe fitters, HVAC techs, electricians, electrical technicians. These people are going to have jobs for another 100, 150 years minimum. They might have jobs 500 years from now as systems get more complicated anyway, all right? Metalwork, welding. Now, robots can weld, right? They can spot weld. They can even do all – robots can be programmed to do gorgeous welds as long as every weld is the same. Like, you're not going to have a guy come in and say, look, I want to fabricate a thing, and it needs to look like this, and I need these pieces welded together, and I need this other thing welded on it, and I need this part made that goes, you know. No. Now, there might be a lot of robotics, CNC-type machinery, things like that involved in the fabrication process, but it's not going to eliminate the skill and the adaptability of the human who is part of that equation. Again, you're looking 100 years out. Right, they can paint cabinet doors, but they can't go in the on. But they can't go on the house. I'm not sure what that means. But yeah, they can do at least pieces and parts. But there's a difference between having a robot in a factory making cabinets that are all the same. You know, they make this one double cabinet with these doors this way, and it goes by and a spray arm sprays it, a painting or a stain. And a guy that goes into a house. Measures your kitchen and custom builds cabinets, because my kitchen, all my cabinets are custom because everything off the shelf didn't really work for what I wanted. And if you're going to be in the cabinet business, you don't want to be in the freaking prefit cabinet business anyway. You want to be in the custom business, carpentry, cabinet making, things like that. Diagnostic mechanics and machine repair. Yes, there's a lot of technology today that will tell you exactly what's wrong with your car. New little things you can buy on Amazon for not much money. You plug into a port on your car, it tells you what's wrong with it. Yeah, they don't work for everything. And sometimes the error codes they spit out are irrelevant and not really, doesn't mean anything really needs to be done. That just means the car's computer's saying it. It doesn't mean that it's true. Being a good mechanic, and I don't mean just a car mechanic. I mean any type of person we would think of as being mechanical. Somebody that works on elevators, someone that works on all that robotic equipment, right? Yes, there's a lot of code driving it, chipsets and all. There's also a lot of mechanical gearing. And when it breaks, it can't fix itself. So the person that can look at a mechanical system, whether it's on a car or a tractor or a boat or an articulating arm in a factory and figure out what's wrong with it and fix it, that person is not going to hurt for work. Right? EMS skills that involve direct response. Everybody's talking about how AI is going to replace doctors. AI is going to replace the doctors we shouldn't be using anyway. AI is going to be replacing the doctor that right now is probably using AI to get out of medical school. That's the doctors that are going to be replaced by AI. The doctor that you go in and you say, I have this wrong with me, and they just go, yeah, it's this, and that you don't, they don't listen to you. That's what AI is going to replace. And it will probably do a better job than they do. It's also going to rigorously follow the freaking code of medicine as it is written by the people who sell the drugs, the medical devices, and the treatment. So they're not necessarily the doctor you know, and that's what the doctor you go to right now does. You don't want that doctor. So doctors are still going to have a place when you're going to be looking at a lot more opportunity for like direct primary care doctors, like my wife now has. She's like, but I have everything paid for by Medicare. I don't give a shit. I don't care. Karen, what's her nut, gets replaced six times a month at your clinic that you go to or whatever. I had her get a guy, say, you go to this guy when you need to go to the doctor because he's going to see you. You're going to pick the phone up. You're going to call him. He's going to answer the phone himself and help you after hours. That's who you need. That type of doctor is going to still have a place. It's going to be the mass market medical. A lot of people are going to get wiped out. You're still going to need nurses and attendants and stuff like that. People to run things like MRI machines and stuff like that. People to interpret the results with the assistance of an AI. So there's still a future in medicine, but it's not what it used to be. But the emergency medical skills, the trauma surgeon. If you're going to be a surgeon, be a trauma surgeon. Right. We're going to have robotic machines, not in the hands of a surgeon, but in the hands of a computer to do things even as advanced as organ transplants and not that long in the future. Long for me. Right. I'm old. right? But for the person that's in high school thinking about what to do with their future right now, is going to go to medical school. You know, they're looking at what? They're going to get out of high school, 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school. Then they got to do a year of residency and minimum 4 years of internship. They do a year of internship and 4 years of residency. And more than that, if it's surgery, it's more like 7 years of residency before you're fully like free to fly. And if you go into general surgery, I don't know that you're going to have as much to do then as you would if you were in a trauma surgeon role where the guy comes in with an axe in his head, right? The computer can't figure out what to do about that. That has to be done hands-on. And the guy that rides around in the ambulance, right, the paramedics and things like that that have to go into these situations and bring people out of them and try to keep them alive until they get in the hospital, that skill set is not going anywhere due to AI. Artisan and craft work. Anything from things, crafts, things that you know, handmade tools that are in a specific niche to foods, whether it be unique foods that you're growing or producing or value added products that you're putting together. This is a place that, you know, the person who wants to go buy bread, right? And they go to, you know, Jason Fletcher's bakery or whatever, a Redstone bakery or something like that. And it's an artisan bakery and they're making the wheat or they're making the bread with like an Einhorn or a spelt wheat, right? Einhorn wheat rye blend sourdough, right? And they're paying $8 for a loaf of bread. They do not give a fuck how cheap, you know, Wonder Bread is at the grocery store or Arrow Wheat, which isn't wheat, with a list this long. They don't care. They don't care, and the market will not be big enough for that kind of product to fully automate it because it doesn't make sense. You automate things when you fill up train cars full of shit and ship them all over the world. You don't automate things that one store sells that's unique to that store. It doesn't make sense. So anything that's artisan, truly artisan, and has enough horsepower of people with money who want to buy it, that's very AI resistant, even though a lot of AI could be used in that business. That business could be marketed with AI. There could be automated components brought into the business that frees the baker up for more time, the artisan with more time to formulate new breads and to work on new things and to do more to take care of his business and his customer than just make bread, right? So we could still have automation. It doesn't mean that the person goes away. Cosmetology work. Specifically hair care, right? Like the girl I have that does my hair, I really like her, but she works at Supercuts. I bet you, not maybe accounting for this Santa beard, right? And I need to have her trim it one more time before Christmas comes because it's getting a little out of sorts and I still want it to be nice until Christmas. But, you know, other than that, my haircut is pretty formulaic. And I bet you could get to a point where like, you know, you like dead photo booths, right? You sit in a photo booth and it takes your picture, right? Like, I bet you my haircut, you could sit in a booth and you have a picture like from all the sides, like stored your haircut, like Sheldon Cooper haircut records, right? And then you would just sit there, like maybe your head on a chin, like when you get your the X-ray your teeth and the thing goes around your head so you don't move, and it would just and you'd have your haircut. Yeah. Yeah, but the person right now who pays their hairdresser $120, $150 ain't doing that. They ain't doing that. You know who those people are? Mostly women. Not all, but mostly women. They're not going to go do that. And getting to a point where, you know, layers and all the other shit that women have in their hair, that ain't going anywhere. That ain't going anywhere anytime soon. So that cosmetology field, the hair care, all of that stuff, there's a future there long term. And I would say for doing it for dogs too. People are crazy what they'll spend on their dogs. I love my dogs. My dogs are like family. My dogs have eaten food that many people have never had and tasted. I'm still only going to spend so much time groomed. But there are people that will spend a dear fortune monthly on dog grooming. And people that will spend money on things that are not even nice to have and not necessities, but only because they want them, those are good people to be in business with, right? Because you want customers who pay for quality, expect quality, quality you can deliver. And those people are going to pay a premium and they don't give a shit. And that's where you have to focus going into the future. Anything that can be optimized for mass production is going to be optimized for mass production. And that means remove as many humans from it as possible. That's what it means. And the industries that will remain large employers of humans will be industries that do it so well that the very growth of the supply of what they sell will require more people, even with massive automation. So that's the kind of business you want to work for if it's not in a non-brittle skill set. And I would say, what else can you think of? Is there anything you guys can think of that you feel AI won't take away anytime soon? Teaching? It depends. Micro niche teaching, right? But I'm about to put together a course you guys can buy instead of just waiting for the big AI course we can only run a few times a year. I'm going to do a course probably going to sell for $50. It's how to build your own learning plan, right? But I still think there's going to be a place for the teacher who can do things in a different way. And those self-directed learning plans often involve watching videos, reading books, et cetera, that were written by people that actually did the thing that you want to learn. So that's automating finding the material. It's not automating creating the material. And there's the thing about AI and teaching. If I use a history book and give AI the requirement to teach that book, it can even create an avatar, and it can even create an avatar that keeps every student's attention, right? For the 14-year-old boy, it's a teacher with, you know, well-endowed, very pretty, very nice, on his screen. I'm paying attention, right? But I can only get it to teach that book. When you start trying to go more broad with an education, you can't effectively learn from AI unless you already know enough to know that it's wrong for now. It's going to get better about that. And some things are taught wrong on purpose, even by humans. But there's still going to be the potential student, I would say, that would seek out the teacher that they actually trust. And those are your top teachers. And I think that is where the real metric is that we need to be doing right now, especially those of us who are nowhere near the end of our careers. You know, if you're 55 or older, a lot of this doesn't matter as much as long as you've got your life set up well. If you're 25, 30 years old, you have to be thinking 3-4 decades out minimum. And all the flux and change is going to come over those 3-4 decades. So here's the reality. We're never going to get rid of all humans from work. We're going to even talk about that more a little bit later in the episode. But what we're going to do is we're going to clear out waste. We're going to clear. I bet you right now, if you get outside of things like hospitals and ambulances, right? If you get into the office environment that about half of people work in today, half of those half, so that's 25% of all jobs, are so wholly unnecessary, especially if government regulations were to be taken out of the way. If you removed them from all these offices, if you took all offices with more than 50 people in them and cut them by 50% and said you can't hire anybody, you just can't do it, you got to make do with what you have. You can fire somebody that sucks and hire a new person, but your headcount for the next 5 years has to remain level. Not a fucking thing of any real matter would fucking change. The person buying the shit wouldn't notice the difference. The shareholder and the owner would make more money. All the employees could make more money. We have created a make fucking work society. We have classifications of work that have exponential growth between 1971 and today that somehow we didn't even need those people in 1971. Like HR Karens. We have more HR Karens today than we possibly need. Lawyers, we have more of them. And by the way, AI can knock out all of the value of, like, say, 50% of your lawyers. And a ton of what you think a lawyer does is actually done by a paralegal, and we can really replace them with an AI unit. Or we can take one paralegal and give her AI or him AI, and they can do the work of 10 paralegals, thereby giving us 90 people, 9 out of 10 people we can flush out of that system. It is too much government nonsense. Baptizing fire saying that's a big part of what I'm talking about. But as you automate processes, those are the first people you can get rid of. If I can automate the compliance, then I don't need the person anymore, and then they go. So the way that the informed, smart, hardworking person needs to be thinking today, whatever it is you do, you should do something that you have enough innate talent and passion for that you can study, drive, work, build, continuously learn, continuously improve, and relatively quickly you can become in, you can enter the realm of the top 20% of your space. Most people never even think about that. Oh, they think about getting promoted at work because it's more money, but they don't really think about the plan to get there. Hey, I show up all the time and Bill's an asshole. Why don't you report promote me instead of Bill? But the person doing this, even if they're thinking about getting to the top 20% of their company, they're not talking about the top 20% of their industry. You can be a top 20%er in your company, but if your company is at the bottom 50%, what does that say about you? What does that say about you? Where would you rank? Like, we know we rank chess players by a score. Like, if a 2,000 was a perfect score, that would be your top 1% or all 2,000 or above. You're going to rank like an 800. You ain't even close to the top 20%. Top of the company, but not top of the industry. That might sound like you're shooting too hard. You know where you should be shooting? 20% is a minimum to be non-brittle going forward in this world. To be a top earner and non-brittle in your space, you should be shooting for top 5%. Not necessarily earning, skill, knowledge, ability, and reputation. Now, here's the thing. Skill. That is a matter of continuously getting better at what you do. Now, since I don't know what you do, you have to figure out the thing that it is that you do, right? And how do you get better at that skill? Knowledge. Again, knowledge. Knowledge is pretty simple. It's more information about your space, your responsibilities, et cetera, right? All the things I said are things in your control. Not just that you can influence, you can control how much you learn, how long you work, how much extra you do, right? Reputation. Reputation is mostly about always doing well, but also making sure that people know that what you did worked out. That can be done largely with things like a social media presence. What you can talk about. Successes, talk about your successes. You know who doesn't have a good reputation? My company sucks. Everybody here's an asshole. No one appreciates how wonderful I am. Bullshit. You don't have to like praise your company to praise the things that you are doing for your company, but not be negative about your company. Because if you work for Spacely Sprockets, right, and I'm Cogswell Cogs, and you're always talking about how bad Spacely Sprockets sucks, a little pop culture Gen X throwback here, right? I don't want to hire you to come make my cogs. Because you're going to come over here, no matter how good you are, you're going to go out there and talk about how bad we suck. Because I know that's a you problem. It's not a me problem. And it's not a Spacely Sprockets problem. It's a you problem. You know, in writing my book, I am opening my chapters with a quote or two. And one of the quotes I just used in the book is, you do not see things as they are. You see things as you are. So if you're a positive person, you see positive things. If you're a negative person, you see negative things. But reputation is about seeing the positive and marketing the positive. When you get a new certification, you should talk about it, right? People start to just think your name and accomplishment start to come together. And then when they actually check with your references or they check your work record or whatever, they're like, oh, this guy actually, the marketing matches the product. Well, now you're highly valuable. So you need to be shooting to be in that top 5%, at least perceived to be that good. Then you'll always have a home because somebody always wants to take a top producer, a top earner away from their competition. In fact, when you have a job, you'll be more marketable than if you end up without one. I've taught you guys that for years as well. So we got to shoot for that top 5%. And then we have to work on the other stuff to drive down our cost of living across time. Like I said, there is going to be no, don't hope that the orange man will, you know, sit in the lotus position and rub his Buddha belly and then name a new Fed chair, and then the whole world's going to get better and your cost of living is going to go down. It could go down a little bit in the short term, but the long-term trajectory is locked in. I actually see another big boom coming, an orange man boom, and I think it's going to start next year, and it's going to be really good for some people. It's not going to help others, but it's not going to have legs, you know, a decade in. It's not. And even if it had legs a decade in, it ain't going to have a two or three. Like, the problem for the youth is also an advantage. You have so much time ahead of you, but you don't have enough time behind you. Those of us 50, 60, 70-year-old people, we've been through boom and bust enough time to know the boom always is followed eventually by a bust. We know to expect that. The youth still have this belief that, well, when things get better, they'll just stay better. That's not how that works. Like, you're still waiting for a mythological time to come back, because as true as it is about how bad inflation is, especially inflation measured in your life force, it ain't like things were super easy in 1970 either, or in 1950, or in 1930, or in 1910, or in 1890. Whatever you believe about those time frames, if you think everything was just easier, you're wrong. There was easier in some ways and harder in others. And that's the push-pull of life. That's just the way that it is. But we can drive down our cost. One, I will not write a check and pay off my house. I could, but I won't. It's my primary residence. But when we pay the last payment, I won't remortgage it. And it might actually get low enough someday that I'll pay it off. But I have a 2.9% mortgage on my home. If I can't make 2.9% on my money, I don't deserve my money. So if I can't do better than my mortgage, I don't deserve the money that I have. So that I would have to be so inept with money that I'm like, I would take 2.9% on this money for the next 10 years to buy it off 10 years of the mortgage. But as we pay off housing, we shouldn't continuously remortgage it, because all we're doing is resetting and losing. The only advantage inflation gives a homeowner is that your cost of living does go down across time. And eventually it goes to zero plus property taxes and insurance, right? Grow some of your own food or hunt and gather. Like, the food bill's huge compared to what it used to be. Like, here's the thing. I can run my garden in 2025 for the exact same monetary cost that I could run my garden for in 2008. I can run my garden for the same monetary cost as my grandfather could when he was teaching me how to do it in 1984. My cost of operations to produce food has not gone up, but the cost of food has gone up. So if growing a garden was an economic good decision in 2010, it's a much better decision in 2025. You see how that works. And in fact, gardens are a different kind of real asset. That the underlying value stays and grows for the owner of the asset, even if it's not directly transferable. You know? Because if you do it right, your soil gets better. Your varieties, because now you start line breeding some of your favorite stock, and they get more resilient. And so there's actually less input. So the cost to produce the food goes down. And then when it comes to like hunting, gathering, fishing, things like that, if you love doing the activity, then the food is better than free. It's better than free because you're literally being paid to fuck off. I mean, that's the way when I, like, what sucks in Texas is if I want to shoot a deer, I have to pay for it. And my cost relative to the pound of meat isn't much better than beef at the grocery store. Product might be better, but that cost ratio is not there. But like when I grew up in Pennsylvania, and we could just go into the public woods and shoot a deer. I like shooting deer. I like being in the woods. I like sitting up in a tree and watching wildlife. It's enjoyable. It's a pastime. People go bird watching. It's like bird watching with a gun for big giant squirrels. Okay, it's free food. And again, as long as I can keep the cost level or downward pressure, the value of the production goes up over time. Another thing we can do is more of us need to start using self-directed or what I would call boutique education over college. This is the old saying. I talk about it all the time. It's not mine. I have no idea what its original source was, but it's you don't want a drill bit. You want a hole. I need a hole in that wall. I can knock a nail in it. That's a hole. I can hit it with a hammer. There's a hole, right? If it's a piece of metal, I can blow a hole through it with a torch. I can use the drill bit. I can use a saw. That's drywall over there. I can use a knife, make a hole in it. I want a hole. Now, sometimes the only way to get the kind of hole that I need, a specific size and a specific material with a certain absence of shrapnel and slag on the side, is a drill bit. Sometimes I absolutely need a drill bit. Sometimes I need a specific kind of drill bit, but sometimes I don't. See what I mean? Okay. So when it comes to an education, if you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a high-level engineer, and you want to work for, like, you want to be an engineer for an aerospace company, in many instances, there will be not only a type, you will need college, you'll need a specific type of college, a specific level of college. And you're going to need a discipline to go along with it in the, to do the academic career to get the degree. Because even in this world where we have all of these kids that come out of school and they are ignorant AF, okay? I've come up with a new word, by the way, willfully retarded. Now, if you really want to understand why I'm using willfully retarded instead of willfully ignorant, go to the dictionary, look up the definition of willfully, and look up the definition of retarded, and put them together, and you'll see what I mean. And we have many willfully retarded college students. They come out with these degrees in communications or liberal arts or whatever the hell they're teaching them today, and they can't do anything, and they don't know anything, and a willfully retarded orangutan could get through school and get C's or maybe better in their thing if it could talk and agree and nod its head and do what it's told to do. Yeah, there are that is not all college degree paths that are like that, okay? If you go to MIT to be a fucking engineer, you better be tip-top person and you better put your entire heart and soul into it. You ain't going to make it. You know, Michael Saylor talked about his first class at MIT. It was an engineering class, and he realized real quick that he was no longer the smartest person in the room. He had just grown up always being the smartest person in any classroom. Anybody threw anything out, he knew an answer to it. He knew more than the teachers. He knew more than all the kids around him. He learned super quick. He just had that kind of mind. Gets to MIT, everybody he's sitting next to is just like him. The professors are smarter than him, and they hand them a problem, and it takes them 30 minutes for all these smart kids to figure out. The teacher doesn't have an answer to this either. Those types of paths are still hard. Don't ever think when I talk shit about the average college experience that I mean all, because average is not all. There's median and there's average. You go do the rest of the work there for yourself. So we're going to have to continue to build up the education knowledge and skill set, but we live in a world today where you do not need to always have a certificate to be able to do something. And the kind of jobs that people are that are going to be non-brittle jobs, you might need certifications for, like, you know, electrical apprentice and journeyman and things like that. But there's also going to be a lot of these jobs. You talk to somebody, you want a job at a machine shop, and you say you can do a thing. And they say, well, you know, what experience? Well, I got this and I learned this and I did that. But hey, why don't you just give me something to do? I'll do it for free. You can look at my work. Or a welder. Here, you want to know why I'm worth this much? Give me the stuff. Watch me weld. Watch my safety practices and my quality of work output. And when you lay down that bead and it's beautiful, right? Then the guy that's looking to hire you goes, all right. Well, there's a lot of things like that. Those are just obvious ones. Where once you can do the thing, the degree doesn't matter, right? The fact that you can do the thing matters. Sales is like that. Almost every big-time sales job out there has a degree requirement. Once you start selling, though, you find the one way that you can, you know, wedge your ass, because that's what I did. You wedge your ass into someone that has to settle for you. And then you master your craft. and you start taking business from the company that wouldn't hire you, and you say to them, hey, are you tired of me kicking your ass? You'd be a little nicer than this, but this is the gist of it. Are you tired of me kicking your ass? There's a solution. There's a solution. So skill development, we need to take more of a self-directed approach. We have YouTube University, and we have legitimate educational outlets that are free. Michael Saylor, is it Saylor University or something like that, where he put together like entire college curriculums completely for free. We live in a world where we can move around data, where everybody can have the best instructors, and we're still spending $20,000, $30,000 a year to tie up 4 years or more of our life to go live in a dorm room and go from classroom to classroom and spend so much time there that we don't have time to earn income while we're learning. This has to end. This system was never real. And it's now in a point where as the economy and the economic system that drives this economy is aging out of its days of illusion, the whole thing's cracking and breaking. The whole thing's cracking and breaking. There was never a time when the original university system was built that anybody that was part of building it and teaching people ever saw it as a place that 70 to 80% of people would go, which is what it's turned into. And it doesn't make sense. You don't need a college degree to do 90% of the work. So only about 10% of people need to go to college. I'm not saying there's not an advantage to going. I'm saying need, as in society needs you to get this education. That reality is hitting right now smack in the face of society who bought into bullshit for about 50 years. Every little Johnny and every little Susie has to go to college or they're going to be a janitor was never true, but it's less true now than it ever was because we have, you know, people love the word democracy, right? Right. We have democratized education. We've made it accessible to all. If you don't get an education today, you don't want one. So we need boutique and self-directed learning. Boutique is like a coding camp or it's a specific certification, right? Like, it's a credential that once you have it, it matters to people that hire you, whether that be as an independent or an employee. We also all should be creating multiple streams of income. I mean, you should at least kick around the idea of becoming a landlord of a second property. Why wouldn't you? It's somebody else buying another real asset for you. It may not be for you. I didn't say you should do it. I said you should kick around the idea. You should actually run the numbers. You should start window. You know how much it costs to window shop property? $0. Instead of doom scrolling short videos of kids, I don't know, eating Tide Pods or whatever the fuck they do for attention now, right? See, I don't know what they do because I don't pay attention to it, right? Instead of doing that, why don't you shop properties? The only time people shop properties now when they're trying to buy a house and they're looking for a way that they can explain why they can't afford a house. So they look at places they know they can't afford so they can put up a picture on social media and say, see, I can't afford a house. And you want to make that person really mad, take 5 minutes, look at their zip code, find something they can't afford and show it to them, and then they'll go on a tirade about why it's unlivable. And they wish they could buy a house like their dad bought or their grandma bought or whatever, and they wouldn't live in that fucking house if they could for free right now. They just wouldn't do it. So you should be at least window shopping that and checking that out. But what are the other things you could do to earn income, right? And income can be a passive flow of an investment. It can be consulting work. It can be leasing or renting something out. It can be a small side business. It can be a side hustle off of something like a homestead. There's dozens and dozens of ways to do this. The best way is to build a business that is so robust that you can live off of it and then figure out peripheral functioning stacking into that business. That's not going to work for him. Not just like not everybody should go to college. Not everybody should have a fucking business. You have to, I want to say you have to be built different, but I don't think people would, if I didn't explain it, you wouldn't know what I meant. When I say you have to be built different, I don't mean that genetically you have to be built different. I don't believe that. If you have an IQ of like 100 or greater, you can be. I've seen people that have like an 85 IQ and they're pretty damn good entrepreneurs because they're too stupid to know that they're failing and they work through their failures and eventually they find success, right? But Like if you have 100 plus IQ, which is pretty average, by the way, you can be an entrepreneur if you have the wherewithal. When I say built different, I often mean that they have consciously built themselves into a new being to be an entrepreneur. Like something in them made them realize, oh, all the people that I look at who seem really happy with their lives and they have money and they don't ever worry about getting fired. And even though they might have political opinions, they really don't give a fuck who's in office. And when I ask them about a football game, they're like, I don't know. I was, you know, out fishing or I was working or whatever. Like all of them own businesses. I think I should do that. And because they have that epiphany, they say, okay, I'm going to try to have a business. And they try to, you know, set up some little, like as a kid, you do like a lemonade stand or they go, this is actually hard. And then they bifurcate. Half of them just fall back into the world like, best, I better get a job. And then half of them keep pursuing this, even if they get a job. They might work for 20 years of their life working for other people, but it's always there. And they're working on improving themselves. They're constantly working on their internal dialogue. They're constantly learning techniques. They're constantly window shopping business models. They're reading books. They're listening to audiobooks. They're looking at success stories. They're deeply curious as to what, and because they do this over time, they build themselves anew. So when I say they are built differently, I mean they're built differently because they chose to build themselves differently. And this is no different than you have two twin brothers, right? But they're separated at birth and they grow up very similarly, but they're not talking to each other. So they don't have that sibling rivalry thing going on. And one guy, you know, based on his exposure in life decides, I want to be, you know, a doctor or something. He goes to college and he's good. He's smart. The other kids obviously got the same innate IQ. He's got the same genetics. If you did a DNA test, you can't tell them apart, right? He goes off to school and becomes a successful doctor. The other guy, and he's always a good looking guy, right? But he's a very average built guy. The other guy, he gets deeply into sports. He pursues a career in the NFL, right? He's so good he plays professional football. In fact, the way they find each other is one day the doctor actually has a day off. He watches a football game. There's this guy that looks just like him on the camera. Holy shit, who is that, right? Figures out it's his brother. But this guy, you know, he's got 50 more pounds of muscle on his body. How to get there? He exercised those muscles. He ate to build muscle. He built himself into a professional athlete. But he can't do brain surgery. His twin brother, who's nowhere near the physical specimen he is, in some ways, he's also an elite athlete. Like a neurosurgeon is not, the athlete's not the right word, but he's an elite performer. Top neurosurgeons, the skill it takes for that steadiness, the acuteness of vision, right? I one of my friends was a surgeon who ended up with a very severe injury to his left hand and had to sell his practice. Because if he went to a doctor today and examined his hand, they would say you have full mobility in your hand. You have full use of your hand, but he doesn't. Not the fine work of a surgeon doesn't have it. So both of those people built themselves, even though they started with the same DNA. So if you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to build yourself into an entrepreneur. Nobody's born one. Some have predispositions, just like some have a predisposition to be a football player, or some have a predisposition to be a martial artist, or some have a predisposition to be an artist or a vocalist. But you still have to build yourself to become great. And the beauty of an entrepreneur is it's not like being a vocalist. If you're going to be a vocalist, you have to have a good voice. You have to have at least a voice that can be trained. And like, I don't. Trust me. You don't want me to sing. And you don't want me to sing happy birthday at half the volume of everybody around me in a group. I'm that bad. So I could never be a vocalist. But there is no one that can't be an entrepreneur if they're willing to do the work, because you have a thousand different ways to go, and you can find something that you would be good and passionate at. That is your number one way out of this mess, if you're willing to do it with multiple income streams. And here's the thing, the truth about the future, it's fucking terrifying, but we should be bold anyway, because there will be success stories in the future Huge success stories, small success stories, mid-sized success stories, lots of billions globally, billions of success stories. There's no reason one of them can't be you. But it's still terrifying. And here's what I mean. There's no going back. Like, I do think some of the things that Trump is doing will be economically effective if he quits fucking around with foreign policy to the point where he's fucking risking everything. Because, like, the blowing up the Venezuelan drug boats and shit and then be bragging about it and video getting out like that, this risks impeachment going into his after the midterms and things like that in a very real way. And you quit saying stupid shit, you know, and quit funding Ukraine while you say you're not funding Ukraine, because the NDAA that the Congress just passed, that he's going to sign, he's got like $300 million a year for the next 2 years for Ukraine. So, like, even the things that are working are not going to really work long term, I don't think, anyway. We don't bet on it. Let me put it that way. You know, Lynn Alden, very well-known economist in the Bitcoin space, often says nothing stops this train. And people think that Lynn's talking about Bitcoin. In other words, Bitcoin's great. It's going to go up forever. Well, the determination in that is actually the same. But when she says nothing stops this train, it's a negative. It's not about Bitcoin. Bitcoin's just one of the alternatives to the train. The train is the devaluation of your money. Nothing stops this train. It's going to run right into the ground eventually. It has to. There's no other place for it to go. No currency ever built on a fiat system ever survived. Why would we're so special? We're the ones that can do it. It's nonsense to believe that. There will be an eventual reset or series of resets economically. We don't know when. We can't know when. I get the question all the time from people. How many years do we have? I was asked that question the year I moved here, so it would have been 2013, by a very well-known author, a gentleman named Brad Thor. Brad was at my house for an after party from a big event. And he said, Jack, how long do you think we have left before the economy completely comes apart? And I said, I don't know, but at least 10 years. I completely turned him off at that point. He didn't really want to talk to me after that. He thought I was crazy. I said, I think it's longer than that. He could not get his head around it, that it was longer than 10 years. Well, here we are, 2025. It's a shit mess, but it's still functional. It still works. You can still go get shit. Your money's worth less, but it's not worthless. Yeah. So it could go another 10, 20, 30 years. I don't know. I know that there will be periodic resets along the way. We got to this full fiat economy over a period of time. We had the crime of 1873, then a big depression in 1907 or 1909 that was used to sell the Federal Reserve in 1913, which was then eventually parlayed into banning gold and buying it back at a ridiculously inflationary rate. With FDR's executive order, and then the next year, Congress putting out the Gold Revaluation Act, and then in 1964 with the Silver Coin Act, taking the silver out of our money, and then finally in 1971. So it took from 1873 to 1970 to fully get into this world. So there's no reason it might not take that long to completely get into the next world. We're going through resets right now. We just often don't recognize them. And a lot of people get hurt even when they're not recognizing why they're being hurt. So we need to be thinking about that. There's no going back. We don't know when. We only know that there has to eventually be a full reset of the economic system, because this one cannot continue in perpetuity. And someone's going to be holding the bag when it happens. It's like a giant game of musical chairs, and there's not a deficit of one chair, like the game. There's a lot of chairs with a lot of deficits called derivatives. And eventually when the music stops, it's a lot more than one kid out. You don't want to be one of them. It's going to get worse before it gets better. Waste must be shed. We have a system rotten with waste. And I don't just mean material. I mean body count. I mean human capital. I mean, we have companies that are so overstaffed, it doesn't make any sense that why this person has a job. I'm glad they do in a way, but I also know that when push comes to shove and reality comes to bear, that I guarantee you I can walk into an office with 50 people. And if I take a senior management person and I pull them aside and say, look, I need 5 people out of here. The first thing I say, I can't. Let me explain this. Here's how it's going to work. I'm going to walk out there. I'm going to go to a bathroom and take a shit. That's going to take me about 10 minutes. I'm going to take my phone and read an article. So you got a full 10 minutes. I'm going to wipe my ass and I'm going to come back in here. And if you don't have a piece of paper in front of me with 5 people you could do without, the first person I'm going to put on my list is you. Bye. Before that toilet goes, he's going to be sitting there with that fucking list and he's going to know in his heart and in his soul that he doesn't need those people. He's going to know it. That's 10%. Boom. Any office, 50 or more people. And I could, if it's 100 people, I could tell him 10. He's going to walk around while I'm taking a dump going, I don't even know who that person is. But that motherfucker ain't done shit. Hey, dude, what's your name? Why? Just, it's a promotion list. Oh, I'm Tom Peters. Okay, Tom Peters, fucking fired. Like, when we have a society where that is true, this purge has to come. Think about it this way. This is not against women. I know somebody's going to try to make it against women. Just by the numbers reality. The vast majority of women prior to the 1950s did not work. And even in the 50s, not many of them did. 60s, most women didn't work. Most women, especially once they got married and had their first kid, they stopped working at least full time. Women didn't really start to go to work heavily until the 70s. And everybody thinks, women's liberation. Like everybody's just like, I can't wait to fucking go to work, right? Come on, get the fuck out of here. People go to work because they have to, not because they want to. The freaking stagflation of the 1970s had more impact on women going to work than women's liberation. It said it was okay for women to work. Far more so. Because women worked in the 50s and the 60s, so obviously they could work. Now, maybe certain things were walled off unfairly, I'll admit. But women went to work because they had to, not because they were permitted to. Right? It wasn't so I could make my own money, right? Because a lot of these women that went to work back then, they were married. People still had it was a very high marriage rate at that point. So most people were married in their 20s, and they still went to work. They had kids. They found child care, or grandma took care of the kids. They went to, because they had to, because they needed the money. But somehow, the needs of society were fulfilled with about half the body count per capita working. Now we have more technology, more efficiency, and more productivity than ever, but we need twice as many people to do it. Does that make any sense to you at all? Does anybody understand how that would possibly be the case? The good news is the fact that it even can happen means that the job losses don't have to be as bad as the TV keeps making you think with Elon Musk telling you you got to have UBI or we're all going to die. But it also shows you that our society can run with all needs met with a hell of a lot less people working than we have working now. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting, isn't it? So entire industries and sectors are going to be gutted during the shifts and the elimination of waste. That's going to happen. And that has a spiraling effect, right? Because even if you don't lose, that hurts the economy as a whole because your neighbor doesn't have a job and your neighbor, other neighbor has a job, but his wife doesn't anymore. So that's going to happen. Again, how fast it happens is the variable, and what the where the bottom is before the rebuilding and the reset is finished is, we don't know when. We just know that. And the way we know that is you look at every freaking country, every region, every dynasty, every empire that ever fucking did what we did, and it always ends the same way. It always has, and it always will. Because the temptation to print out of thin air is too strong for man to resist. And the willingness to accept it when it's working for you is too strong for man to resist. And the fallible nature of the system is so abysmal that failure must eventually come. Especially when the governing authority doesn't use the printed money to invest in assets. It buys social programs and builds subpar infrastructure. You know, the Chinese, or the, actually the Mongolian Khans did it for centuries. One of the Mongolian Khans, one of the Khans very soon after Genghis created one of the first real fully fiat note-based systems in the world. And it lasted for centuries. But the Khan bought all surplus assets and stockpiled them to be owned by the nation itself. And so it had intrinsic wealth that could be used in the future. That's how it, what do we have? Fucking dusty gold in Fort Knox that hasn't been audited since the fucking 70s, if then. That's it. And we haven't added to that stockpile for shit. Just saying. Some Bitcoin we stole from freaking Ross Ulbricht. I mean, those are like the two biggest intrinsic. Otherwise, we have a bunch of fucking buildings that aren't really useful for anything. Just saying. There's not enough. There's more square footage to rent to companies than companies to rent the square footage if we took that approach. The fuse was set in 71. When we left what was left of the gold standard, and we didn't have a choice. I've often said that Nixon gets way too much blame for that. And it's like having a patient poorly treated for a cancer that would have been curable 6 years ago by one doctor. And the patient finally comes into the office of the new doctor who maybe didn't know what to do, but at least could have 6 years ago done the right thing to save that patient. And the patient walks in, sits down, and the new doctor goes, "Bro, you got like 4 weeks, no matter what I do. Come on, doc, you got to help me. You don't have a pancreas anymore. Your liver's 90% gone. I can't fix this. Come on, man, you got to, I can't." And then you fall over and die the next time you come to his office, and he calls time of death, and you say it's his fault. That's Nixon with the gold standard. Johnson murdered the gold standard. Nixon called time of death. One way or another, that fuse was fired up and lit by Nixon in 71. And it could only run so long. And more than 50 years, I got to tell you, there's a lot of economists that forecasted gloom and doom when it happened, that if they were still alive, would be shocked that it lasted 50 years. They would be I guarantee you, there were like hard money economists, you know, people that were Austrian economists and things like that. They did not believe, especially experienced guys, 50, 60 years old, guys would be 100, 110 today if they were still alive. They didn't think there was any way this thing would make 5 decades. They would have been shocked. And it did. But that also tells you something. How much longer it can go, not good. More opportunity, though, exists than ever before. For all the talk about AI going to take our jobs. They're going to take our jobs, right? South Park, anybody, right? It's not just a taker. To the wise, it's a giver. It's a blessing. Sometimes I'm trying to get something done with AI, I quit and just do it myself. But when it works, I move so much faster, so much quicker. I am so much better because of it. What I can do as one person with the technology that we've had since 08 when I started this show is pretty amazing, really. All the things I can do is a one-man operation. It's a kind of insane. And I couldn't have done it 20 years earlier, even if I had the knowledge that I have, right? The tools weren't here. But the speed and the things I can do as one man today with cross-platform use of things like Gemini and ChatGPT and Midjourney for artwork are insane. The ability that I'm teaching this AI course, but I'm only able to teach it because it's an AI course. I don't have the time to do this any other way. I made a course that is me as an AI. It basically gets a person the ability, maybe it's not quite as good as me sitting in your business with you as your business operations and marketing manager, but it's close for a fraction of the price. There's a million ways to use AI that we haven't even thought about yet to be more powerful as individuals. Platforms now link providers and consumers like never before. Uber and Lyft, right? But there's Airbnb, right? Or Vibro. So going into the real estate business in the past always meant truly being a landlord. Now you can find a property, like a set of properties. You can examine them on Airbnb and Vibro. You can build an economic model and you can look at comparable homes in the market and see how you can look at the entire, like, when do they rent? When do they not rent? What is their total occupancy for year? What are their rates? What are the fees that they pay? You can figure it all out. You can build a model and go, I can buy this house for this much money. And I know it has a small cash flow. It has it will produce in the first year an emergency fund to cover maintenance. And after that, that small cash flow can be mine and somebody else is buying the property for me. And I'm going to leverage money with a mortgage going into it in the first place. And I financially know that that model works. Try that in 1990. Get the f*** out of here if you think you could have done that in 1990. And you don't even have to have like high-end research software or something, right? You can literally, there's tools that will accelerate it for you using APIs and shit, but you can literally manually gather the freaking information to do that. And you can even, like, if you have, like, you need some money, you can go to an investor to get started, like a private investor, with the numbers. And say, this is why I know I can pay you back. And this is why I know it's a good investment. And a person that understands money understands numbers. Very few people have and keep money who don't understand numbers. Plenty of people have money that don't understand numbers, but they don't keep money. They're people that piss money away. They're lottery winners. But, I mean, even like small side hustles. Like, do you know there's a site called Rover? ROVR.com. Do you know what you do there? Well, you're either a customer or you're a provider. And if you're a provider, you do things like pet sit. Anything from you go by the house twice a day and let Fluffy out and feed her and pet her and make her feel happy. Or you actually like couch surf because you live at somebody's place while they're on vacation. And all kinds of shit in between. It is the Uber of pet sitting. There are sites where if you are a handyman, you can constantly get business and set up a profile. And even if it's not where all your business comes from, it's a start. Because if you're a good handyman, if you're a good contractor, anybody like that, what you want to do is when you get that customer, you don't want them ever going through that platform again. Ever. I don't care what some terms and conditions say. You're leaving them with your business card and you're hitting them up for referrals. And what you need to establish success in that business is a book of business. You need to be able to go to your next potential customer and they say, well, have you done this before? Why? I'm glad you asked. You pull out your 3-ring binder. You start showing them what you did. And what I would do in that space, being a sales, natural salesman and marketer, every job that the customer was happy with, I would say, would you give me a quick handwritten note saying what you liked about what I did for you? Don't even ask for a letter, like a letter of recommendation. Sounds too important. Just, you know, Bill and his crew came in and did my bathroom, and this is what I liked about it.
Okay.
And I would have the little see-through sheets. You know, you slide papers in, like almost like a photo album. And at the end of each project, that handwritten on multiple different states, whatever they have available, write it on a fucking paper bag and cut it out with a pair of scissors. I don't care. Notebook, whatever. You go in even with just 10 of those, if you don't get that business, your price was wrong or they didn't have the money in the first place, right? Or there's just something wrong with them. I've always said in sales, there's two things you can't sell to, ignorance and poverty. They're you know, and I really say willful ignorance. And as I said earlier, I've changed willful ignorance at this point to willful retardation. So there are so many things we can do today. There are many things computers can never do. And a lot of what they can isn't really necessary. So there's all these opportunities for somebody that can use their hands, or their head in ways that computers just don't work yet. A computer is not a good masseuse, and even the best massage chair doesn't replace a good masseuse. Like somebody who actually understands the human body and can actually heal with hands, not by praying and laying hands, but actually can find the parts of your body that are tense and knows how to relieve that tension, that has value. That's just an example. And I had no plan to talk about that today. That's just when I tried to think about something like that, like came to me. There is thousands of things that we can do that no cold ass calculating computer can, and that people want done by humans. Okay. And then the last thing is every shift that we've ever, like I said, every society that built a fiat system destroyed itself. Everyone, always. And these technological innovations have always caused pain. Let's go back to the 1970s for a minute. Again, a lot of women went to work, and a lot of women did the nurse thing, or, you know, the teacher thing, or the daycare thing. But a lot of women went to the office. And we had, if you think back, if you remember, it was an old movie based on a country song by Dolly Parton, 9 to 5. What did all those women do? They were some executive assistants all, but there was a ton of them like in the office scene all the time. What? In the typing pool. The typing pool. They put out a thing and there need to be 3 copies of it. And then she takes the thing and sticks it in it. And put 3 carbon sheets in and 1 front original. And it'd be really accurate because you could do some things to correct something on a typewriter, but it was never really great. So you had to be accurate and fast. And there were tens and tens and hundreds of thousands of women who earned a reasonable paycheck to sit for 8 hours a day and type, and then fucking Xerox comes along, and we need 3 copies of this, and chomp, chomp, chomp. And the entire industry of people who did nothing but copy content for an income went away. What happened to employment in offices for women? Very shortly thereafter, it went up. Well, how's that work? But let's go back in time. We'll go way back in time, and we have a saw mill where they take trees and they turn it into board lumber. Of course, we have no mechanized equipment yet. We have a saw that was made by hand, big saw with 2 things on it. Like we have a crosscut saw. We have a rip saw to go long one. So a sawmill was a pit with some things that would hold this log up. And one dude got down in the saw pit and the other guy stood on top of it. And they literally cut the length of the tree in a rip. So they didn't really cut it. They ripped it. And then they got to the end, right? And then dude in the pit got out. It was his turn to be on the top because being in the pit sucked. It was hot and all sawdust fell on you. And he got down there and they swapped and they made another rip. And they had another rip. And they made another rip. And until the thing was gone and you just had 2 cutoffs and all your boards, right? Okay, great. So somebody figures out, hey, if we make the blade in a circle, I make this giant spinning cutty thingy, it can rip the shit out of these trees. And if we hook it up to the same shit that turns a grist mill, we can just push the tree against the blade and the modern sawmill was born before anybody knew what the fuck electricity was. And the sawmen who had a shitty job went on strike and said, you're threatening our future, our livelihood, and you're going to crash the economy because we're tradesmen and we earn a good living because we do hard work, and this technology is going to destroy the world. And the economy didn't get destroyed, and the economics of the improvement and greater and faster and more accurate productivity won out, and somehow those guys found something to do. 1970s, 80s typing pools, sawmen in the Middle Ages Same phenomenon. Why do you think this is going to be different? But this time is different. And when it was the typing pool and when it was the salmon, it was different. And every other time you used to go to a city when they first started, you know, real mechanization and electronics and shit, and they built a great big skyscraper. You know, I want to go up to the 17th floor. We have an elevator for that. What's an elevator? Come here and I'll show you. Well, I don't know how it works. Does it matter? You know, there's a guy in the elevator. He's your pilot. He will take you to floor 17. Required a little bit of skill to use an elevator at that point. Well, they simplified the fucking elevator. And Elijah, what's his name? I can't think of his last name right now, created the cable break. And that made elevators a lot safer. And push 17, you'll go there. Unless you can't fucking read numbers, which you probably don't need to be in this building if you can't, you can get to floor 17 all by yourself now. And, oh my God, do you know how many elevator operators, highly trained, dedicated men are going to... Bullshit. They all found something to do. When Henry Ford didn't invent the car, but he made the car affordable, think of all of the people who lost jobs. All of the poor horses that lost jobs. All the people who put shoes on the horses lost jobs. Do you see what I'm saying? To actually run out of opportunities, we have to run out of problems. If there's problems, there'll be jobs solving those problems. You see how that works? If we were to get to a point where computers and automation could so do everything that there were no problems, you wouldn't have a fucking problem. So why would you complain? There is going to be a resurgence of purpose in humans. The problem we have, the real problem we have, is not that we will not have a place for people to go. We have people incapable of going to those places because they are not adaptable and they are very brittle. To survive these types of fluctuations, one of the one thing that's really different isn't the situation itself, it's the state of the people in the situation. Your grandfather, your great-grandfather, and your great-great-grandfather, one thing in common, they were all fucking hard-ass men. Even if they were cripples, they were hard-ass crippled men. They were tough. The nicest old men I knew when I was a little kid, there was a piece of them you could just see, they were fucking hard, hardened people. They had been through the Great Depression. They had been through a world war. Some of them that I knew had been through two of those fucking wars. Okay? Some of them had been through, I had an uncle, World War II and fucking Korea. I had another uncle, Korea and fucking Vietnam. Right? These were hard people. They could handle, even when they were like, I don't know what to do, get knocked down for a minute or two, and they'd say, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to fucking do something. And we have so many people that are soft. The words of Jamie Kennedy's character in Malibu's Most Wanted, right? Weak, half, was it? Weak, half stepping, moist ass biatches, right? I can't remember the exact line. Half stepping, moist ass biatch. That's what the society is full of. There was a joke at the time. It was the 90s. Now we have them by the million. And when people get into stress and they don't know what to do, the one thing they do is blame others for their problems. And this is why governments love this situation, because then the government says, those people over there that are actually making it work, that actually make the few things that still make your fucking miserable life bearable, they're the problem. If we just stop them from doing what they're doing and make them give their shit to you, everything will be wonderful. And then you get communism, which has worked out so perfectly well every time. It's been, oh, wait a minute, that never happened. At least you think that Karl Marx made Marxism and communism. He just made the current academic version of it. Many nations have tried that too, just like fiat currencies. And that's always led to fucking mass death, mass starvation, and mass destruction. But governments always think they're the ones that can do it right. So that's all the shit we have coming. But we have all this opportunity as well. It's up to you if you're going to do something with it. I really didn't see any questions or comments. Oh, there's a question from Mick. I'll star that one. I'm going to page back a little bit here in the comments. There's a super chat that got auto-starred. If you have any questions or comments for me while I handle the two that I found, go ahead and there's another one. You did it right, Joseph. And I'm looking. If you have a question for me, then put the word question in all caps while I'm answering these, and I'll get to it. This would be how you do it right here, where you see Joseph's question, and what have you. I'm going to start from the earliest forward, though. JD Draft says, and the reason his is a starred question or not, if you super chat me, it goes auto star, and I see it, and I always comment on thank you at least. Even in a factory for a company, you'd all think of if I said what we made, AI is unlikely to take away my job fixing blemished units anytime soon. Oh, okay. I see what he's saying. There's a little word clunkery there, but what he's saying is like they have a factory and they produce equipment, but of course no process is perfect. And with that being the case, sometimes during production or maybe shipping returns or something, you got a product that ain't perfect and it has to be like, it's not so bad that we're going to discard it or sell it as a second. It can be fixed. So the robot can make it, but when the occasional error drop, whatever happens, it takes a human to fix it. Anything that's not 100% repeatable for now is probably pretty safe for humans if as a job. Next up, this one's from 229 Mick. He says, you mentioned Nixon, but off topic. You shared something a while back on how Watergate was generally a setup because he was a threat to the status quo. Could you expand on that? I'll talk about it in the future. That's a show I should do. What Nixon, what really happened or something like that. That's a, he was a big threat to the system. It's probably not for what you think, though. Actually, getting him to do what he did with the gold standard was serving the system. One of Nixon's many big threats to the system is Nixon wanted the United States not just out of the Vietnam War, but out of the war business. And war is a matter of course. War is something we just did whenever we didn't get our way. He wasn't against a strong defense. What he was against is a strong offense, right? And I don't mean the ability to use offensive weaponry. I mean the philosophy of using hard power to enforce America's will all around the world. Nixon was, in lack of a better word, a nationalist. He was an American first person. And you don't really need sources. All you have to do is look at the things the man said and actually did. Watergate wasn't a setup in that he was tricked into doing it. And it really wasn't. It's that the way he was caught was a setup. Think of it like a sting. And it was done for a reason because what he did was largely done in the past. And I'm sure it's been done in the future. And nobody really cared. Nixon was a threat to the system, not only because this is what people don't understand that weren't alive at the time or haven't done the historical research. I was alive, but too young to know. He was incredibly popular. He was incredibly popular until Watergate. So all anybody that's looking back today sees is the stink of Watergate. And of course, there were people that hated him, right? Nothing's changed with Democrat, Republican hate. Democrats hated him, right? So the liberals hated him. So that group already hated him. Then Watergate happened, then the dog pile came, and then it was irrefutable that it actually did happen. And the sensibilities of Americans at the time were such that that would sink a political career. And it's amazing what won't sink a political career now. If you go back into the 1980s, the darling in was either the 80 or 84, the 84 Democratic primary was Gary Hart. Couple pictures circulated with him and his mistress on his boat. They weren't even really doing much, but it was just very clear this man was having an affair on his wife and as a Democrat in a primary. Tanked his ass. You flash forward to the 90s and Bill Clinton's getting a blowjob by a 19-year-old intern in the Oval Office. And while his political enemies try to use it against him, America by and large didn't care, and the ones that said they cared only cared because they didn't want him in office, right? But it wasn't, that was no longer enough to fully torpedo a man from the presidency. At a national level with both parties involved, where in the 80s, even the appearance of it was enough to torpedo somebody in a primary. And today, I don't think anybody would give a flying shit, again, except the people that hate him anyway. Like if it was Trump, oh, I can't believe it. Oh, shut up. Oh, shut up. Like, come on. We all know the guy was banging a porn star and paying her money to do it, and no one cared about that. But now you care about this? Yeah. They didn't even he was convicted for that. No, he was convicted for a bookkeeping entry, and that went nowhere. Anyway, moving on. Joseph says, this isn't exactly related. Well, we'll see then, Joseph. I'm not big on out of left field questions in shows like this, but hoping you can thoroughly comment your current thoughts on stacking silver. Seems like most commenters, influencers also sell silver and gold so hard to trust them. Joseph, bro, this is how silver works with me. 5% to 10% of your net wealth should probably be in precious metals. That's it. That's the whole thing. And do you know how long I've been saying that, man? Since the very beginning of this show, when I had no one as a sponsor who sold silver and gold. And then when I had various dealings with Silver and Gold Shop, Mulligan Mint, other providers over the years, where did my recommendation go? Absolutely fucking nowhere. Where is it today? 5% to 10% of your net wealth. I feel 10% is way too high. And I also don't think that 5% necessarily is your minimum anymore. You can go lower than that if you want to. That's just kind of a range that makes sense. When I say up to 10%, I'm kind of saying, like, I don't get nervous when somebody's holding 10% of their net wealth in precious metals. When they're holding 15, I'm like, I think you're a little top heavy there. So, I also teach that you should manage your precious metal and buy precious metal the same way you do everything else, which is a dollar cost average methodology. So, you know, you buy a little bit here and you buy a little bit there and you average that out and aggregate that out over time. And if you don't want it, I understand. And if you have no precious metals, I'm okay with that. That doesn't worry me. If you have assets and you've just chosen different types of assets for whatever reason, but you know why you're choosing what you're choosing, I'm good. But you'll never hear me like, right now you should go all in on silver. That's dumb. Don't do that. You know, maybe my sponsor would prefer if I did do that. Too bad. Too bad. No one gives a shit. Right? That I don't care that maybe they would like it more if I did that. I don't need them as a sponsor. My rates are on the side if you want to look it up. I haven't turned over a sponsor in years. If I say a spot's open, there's 20 people trying to get it, and I don't charge that much for it because I don't want to be beholden to my sponsors. So I don't know exactly how you're asking that question, but that's my answer to it. I don't really care if you buy silver or gold or not. I just think if you're going to buy silver or gold, it makes sense to deal with my sponsor because they're an honest company that's been honest and square with me for 13 years. And I can talk to the president. And when Lear Capital wanted to be a sponsor, and I said, I've already got a silver sponsor. And they said, well, we'll share space. We don't care. How much does it cost? And I said, before I give you a number, since you're too dumb to look it up on my site, okay, I need the email of somebody at like at least a director level. I need an email and a phone number to a person in your company. If there's a problem and I call that person and they tell somebody in your organization, fix the fucking problem, the problem will be fucking fixed. Yeah. And you know, they said, well, we can give you the head of our customer service department. I'm like, Margaret from Wisconsin can talk to the head of your customer service department. We're not on the same page. We're not on the same language. Go get bent. that's how I handle sponsors in general. So when I tell you there's a good place to get something, I'm doing it more as a service to the audience than to make money. Because you can just take my rates, count my sponsors, do a little math problem and go, well, fucking Jack can't live on that, can he? And the answer is no, I can't. You know why I do that? So that if I have a sponsor that's this wrong and won't fix it, I can go, bye. Goodbye. Out. See you later. But I don't care. Well, you said on the episode a thing and it made our workers butt hurt. I have a solution for you. Check your email inbox. I've just canceled your recurring subscription for your sponsorship fee and I don't need you. Goodbye. I've never had to do it. I got close with one. Because one of you little bitches ran to all my sponsors one time and said, Jack Spirko says dirty words and it offends me. And only one even gave a shit, and it didn't last long. But I would have told that one, bye. In fact, I did. I said, look, you can either get over this or not. It's the same company you've worked with for years. I've always said shit and whatever, you know. It just, that's the way it is. There's a disclaimer on my site. And I said, you have until Monday to tell me if you want to keep doing this or not. Is that how you should handle your sponsors if you're a podcaster? I don't know. If you want to make a lot of money on sponsorships, probably not. But if you want integrity, if you want people to trust you, you probably should. Anyway, with that, on the integrity thing, when I recommend something, you know what? You know it's good shit, or I wouldn't recommend it. And that's what I do when it comes to recommending the products that I actually use at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. This is where I act as an affiliate. And yes, I do make some money. It's a very small amount of money, okay? If I sell something that you buy off of Amazon, for instance, and it costs you about $30, I make about $1.40 to $1.50 off of it on average. Some stuff pays a little bit, but most of the stuff, that's about the kind of money, or maybe $2, right? So it's not highly motivated. I always had people asking me, like, what should I get this or should I get that? So I started saying, you know, like the stuff that I use is the stuff that I recommend. So the upside of this is that when you shop online, if you start your shopping there, you help me out, not just with what I recommend, but anything that you buy. So I appreciate it when you do that. Again, it's tspaz.com. My item of the day today, I haven't had it around for a while. I looked it up. It was August last time I brought this around. It's Olatin's T058 Folding Titanium Scalpel. This is a great little tool. It uses surgical blades that cost way less than $1 a blade. When a blade is too dull to be worth resharpening because it's a softer steel, because it's the same steel they do make that's surgical scalpel steel. So it's a scalpel, right? When they get a little bit dull, you just put them on a butcher steel for about 4 on each side, and they're back to shaving hair. But eventually you get to where, hey, this one ain't worth it anymore. Well, all you do is you just pop the blade off. You just pop that blade off. You can see right there how it attaches on the other side if you're watching the video. That blade comes off. It pulls out. You put a new one on and throw this one away. And that way you're literally walking around with a scalpel. This is the largest surgical scalpel blade that's made. That's available as a standard blade. And that's why they're so cheap, because you're not buying some manufacturer's proprietary bullshit. This is the same thing that a doctor's office or a surgical office would order. They make them in different size. This is kind of the largest one right here. The whole body is made out of titanium, as is the belt clip. So it doesn't stretch out on you, right? Very, very well built. They're about $30. They do have a one hand open feature. And again, you've got super sharp piece of equipment available at all times. And also a blade you're not that worried about, like, you know, something nicer, like, you know, a custom or something like that, right? Like an out the front, like this little guy here. That's an expensive knife. This is a $30 cutting tool. This is not a tactical tool. I would not, like, you better get away, right? It is a cutting tool, but it's a very useful liner lock tool. And since it's small and super light and titanium, it carries beautifully. And you know what it would make this time of year? A fantastic gift for just about any gentleman in your life. I'm sure there's some ladies that would like it as well. But if you give this to a guy, when he opens it, he's going to sit there and he's going to adult fidget spinner it until he gets good at it like this, and he's able to open it with one hand every time, and he's going to like it, and he's going to take it, and he's going to stick that liner lock in his pocket, and he's going to be a happy camper. And you can get yours at tspaz.com, or just go to the survivalpodcast.com and scroll down. If this post is already up for this episode, it'll be right under there. If you go there right now, it'll be right above there. There's a link in the video notes below. If you're watching the video here, if you click that, you'll go over to the audio version of this episode and get all the paraphernalia and links and sources to go with today's episode. Thank you for everybody who tuned in today. I really appreciate it. I hope this episode made you think. And I hope from now on, when somebody starts telling you about inflation rates, a couple things happen. One, you instantly realize, well, of course, this thing is not really more expensive relative to inflation, because that's what the inflation number is, how expensive things are. So if it's a standard thing that follows standard inflation, it is going to be a net zero gain, or close one way or the other, on actual cost in dollars. But dollars are variable, so this person is full of shit or willfully ignorant. It's their choice and how that works out. But what it means is they're not using the right ruler to measure the result. And that then forces you to think to yourself, how much harder do I have to work today than Bill had to work in 1970 or 1950 to get this? And I want that to do two things. I want it to give you your own internal drive to do more than you think you can, because it's what you're going to have to do to thrive in what's coming. But I also want this. I think we have a lot of young, stupid kids. I want us all to remember when we were young, we were stupid kids too. Okay? I want us all to remember that. And I want you to, even though it's hard to deal with the chick with the septum piercing and the blue hair screaming and shrieking and yelling about her student loan debt, I want you to remember that that young lady is going to have to work, if she has a median income job, she's going to have to work 2,956 hours to pay for her degree in bullshit that she was convinced when she was a little girl by people she trusted that that's what she needed to do to be successful. Whereas your boomer grandpa had to work 846 hours to pay for his degree and was much more able to pay, go through school and leave with no debt or very little debt. And if you came up through college in the 80s or 90s, you didn't have it as good as the dude did in 1970, but it was nowhere near what it is today. Nowhere near. And have a little bit of compassion for young people trying to get started out in one of the most, I'm not going to say the worst, because it's not the worst, but one of the most challenging economies other. And my final thought for you guys today on all of this, you know, I did a show last week, and one of the questions I asked it was, did the Great Depression ever really end? And somebody commented on my post about it where I promoted it, and they said, well, I grew up in the 50s, and I can tell you that our standard of living is much better today than it was in the 1950s and 60s. But that wasn't the question that I asked, is it? You can be a comfortable drug addict, but you're still a drug addict with a problem. The problems have only gotten worse. The challenges have only gotten harder. There's always room for winners. The choice to make is, will you do what's necessary to be one? If you will, you can build a great life. You can build a better life if times get tougher, even if they don't.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.